In her first year as a practicing psychiatrist, Christine Montrose had to deal with patients whose mental illnesses were sometimes difficult to diagnose and, as a result, treat. Although she often recognized the patient's symptoms, normal treatments did not always work, and she had to search for other therapeutic options. In her latest book, Falling into the Fire, A Psychiatrist Encounters with the Mind in Crisis, she writes about the patients that challenged her practice and the complicated medical, social, and ethical issues that surround their conditions. It's published by the Penguin Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Christine Montrose to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
In your first book, Body of Work, Meditations on Mortality from the Human Anatomy Lab, you wrote about your work with cadavers as a first-year medical student. Were you already thinking of becoming a psychiatrist when you were doing that?
I was. So I actually went to medical school in order to become a psychiatrist. I was not the kind of kid who knew she wanted to be a doctor, but I was interested in mental illness from an early age.
But how do they justify having you work with corpses if you obviously are, maybe some of the people you're working with don't seem totally alive, but it's not the same thing. Why does a psychiatrist have to have that kind of training?
I think a psychiatrist needs medical training like any other doctor does. We have to understand the way that the medicines we prescribe impact the body. And when we prescribe them to our patients, we have to understand how it might affect their livers or their kidneys, and we need to really have a full comprehension of their bodies.
How much experience had you had working with patients suffering from mental illness before you were hired by a psychiatric hospital?
I trained as a psychiatric resident and certainly saw patients in medical school, but really what drove me to medical school in the first place was I was teaching high school English with a group of pretty underprivileged kids that were dealing with lots of psychosocial conflicts, and many of them were on psychotropic medications. And I realized that I was more engaged with talking to them about what they were going through than necessarily what I was teaching them in the classroom. So I had been interested in madness and mental illness for a long time in college and did some graduate work in creative writing in which I wrote a lot about that, but really began to think more seriously about becoming a clinician when I was working with these troubled teens.
But then you did a residency at a hospital?
I did, yep.
And at a hospital, you see the full range, don't you, from the most benign mental problems to the most serious ones?
Yes. So when you do a psychiatric residency, you see patients as outpatients. You see them in emergency rooms. You see them once they're hospitalized. You work with folks who are struggling with substance abuse and those who are hearing voices and seeing visions. It's really a pretty comprehensive range of symptoms.
How many hours per week did you work?
It varied from time to time. The legal upper limit as a resident is 80 hours a week, and there were certainly some weeks that came close to that, but it varied depending on the service.
I think if I were working 80 hours a week, I would be the crazy one.
Yeah, I was not very pleasant during those times, that's
for
sure.
Because stress really can stretch our abilities.
It can. I think one of the benefits of psychiatric training is, unlike other fields of medicine, we really learn as trainees how to manage that stress in a better way.
When you're diagnosing a patient, do you look for the most obvious answers first?
Sometimes the most obvious answers are misleading. So I think we have to caution against that from time to time. Often the patients we see have been seen many times before and come already with diagnoses that others have established. And I think it always helps to look with a critical eye at those and make sure you agree.
Yeah, because that sometimes what's on the patient's chart isn't really the right diagnosis.
And circumstances change, bodies change, people change. So also it can be deceptive to be lulled into thinking that someone is the same that they've been 10 or 15 years ago.
Well, can you treat a new patient as though he or she is a clean slate?
I think sometimes we're mandated to. I think whenever I see a patient for the first time, I certainly am informed by the decisions that colleagues have made before me. But I think it's a disservice to the patient to rely entirely on that because the presentation may be very different.
What happens if you have treated the patient before? You start with all sorts of assumptions, don't you?
I don't know about assumptions, but I think sometimes it's helpful to have a pre-existing relationship with a patient. I think that there's for psychiatric patients in particular, I think it's important for them to have a trust of their doctor and feel like the doctor really is working with them and an understanding of them. So sometimes having a pre-existing relationship means that there's a shortcut to that trust because they already know you and they know that you understand some of the things that have contributed to their illness in the past.
You write about the admission photos taken of patients on their arrival at the hospital. What assumptions did you and other residents make about patients by looking at those photos?
I write about that because I think there's a well-established pattern in medicine that the further along one gets in one's training, there can be a tendency to become detached or a little cynical in patient care. And I write about the fact that sometimes in the psychiatric patients we saw, there was a game among residents where you would look at the photo and see if you could pinpoint the diagnosis from the photo. And there's, of course, no truth in that whatsoever. But I think it's a measure of the fact that we can lose our empathy the further we go along in training.
A person with wild eyes might just be nearsighted.
Absolutely. And someone wearing a lot of jewelry and wacky hairstyle might be presumed to be manic, but might just be someone with a really creative sense of fashion.
But that does still play into stereotypes, and I'm sure psychiatrists are not immune to them.
Absolutely. We're human beings just like the rest of everyone.
My guest is Christine Montross. Her latest book, Falling Into the Fire, it is published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned that empathy can start to fade after a while. You just see too many people with serious problems, and you build up little emotional calluses?
I think that happens across the board in medicine unless we guard against it. So I think that doctors are day after day seeing people who are in great suffering and in positions of crisis. And I think it takes work to really remain with patients in that mode of their suffering and not feel like one needs to protect oneself from it. And so creating some false distance between you and the patient.
But do you have to establish some kind of a balance between being empathetic and being too distant?
Of course. I wrote about this in my first book about dissecting a cadaver. I think there's some important ways in which doctors guard against being too emotionally involved. I think no one wants the emergency room physician when you come in from a traumatic motor vehicle accident. No one wants the emergency physician to feel very emotionally upset in that moment by your injuries and so unable to care for you. So certainly physicians need to be able to manage their emotions and not be upset by our patients' sufferings. At the same time, we are human and it's upsetting the things that we hear and encounter. And so I think it's important to have a healthy way to deal with that on our own.
What's your opinion about the way the media portray people with mental illness?
Well, I think one of the reasons that I wrote this book was to really try to lend a human element to the situations and illnesses that my patients endure. I think sometimes the media can play a really important role in highlighting the experiences of patients with mental illness. But of course, sometimes in movies and television shows, there's a way that it becomes very humorous or outlandish that's not that helpful.
I just had an experience of interviewing someone. I don't want to go into all the details,
sure.
But she was one of many people being talked to that day in front of an audience, and she obviously had serious problems, and the audience started giggling,
right.
And I was thinking, what is going on in her head? They're laughing at me.
Yeah. I think, you know, the patients that I chose to write about, I wrote about a woman who ingests sharp objects and a man who believes that his face is horribly disfigured, even though, in fact, nothing could be further from the truth. I think I chose those examples in part because I think those are examples that we are apt to push away from and really gain distance between ourselves and those people. But I wanted people to really understand how those symptoms came to be in order to distance themselves less from the patients that I see.
Well, thinking about the media, there was a time when psychiatry was part of the popular culture, both in positive and negative ways. You had Hitchcock making a film about somebody in psychotherapy. In fact, psychotherapists were often figuring out all sorts of things just by talking about dreams. Then there were the crazy shrinks. And then, of course, there was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest,
sure.
Where Ken Kesey created the cruel nurse Ratchet. Are we seeing less of that today? I don't, other than on treatment, In Treatment, which was on HBO, I can't think of anything that dealt with this process, the psychiatric process, in recent years?
I think there's been a real push in a healthy way to destigmatize mental illness and an increasing awareness of the ways in which we've made a spectacle of people with mental illness in the past. And one of the things I enjoyed doing in my book was diving into some of the inglorious history of psychiatry and some of the past ways in which these patients were really treated like a circus sideshow rather than human beings in need of help and care. And I think we're making real progress on that front. But, you know, it used to be that Bethlehem Hospital in London would sell tickets for people to come and see the inmates at the asylum. Fortunately, we're leaps and bounds beyond that now.
In France, there was a film recently about a French doctor, famous French doctor, who brought in people to look at his hysterical female patients, and he would have them disrobe. That was part of the thing. It was almost like a performance piece.
Exactly right. So I write about Jean-Michel Charcot and the mm-hmm. work that he did in Paris and how these young women who were in a very suggestible, fragile position were really on display for the public and for his colleagues. And I think, fortunately, that's a chapter that's in the past of psychiatry.
On the other hand, even when psychiatry was being dealt with in a sympathetic way, for example, there was a best-selling book many years ago called The 50-Minute Hour. There was also a book by Lucy Freeman about her own treatment. And the suggestion there was always that, once you found the key, there was a cure, always. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that we all want from medicine. We want medicine to show us a cure. We want there to be an answer that takes us from illness to health. And I think in all medicine, not just psychiatry, unfortunately, that's not always the case. I think we all really wish for our doctors to have clear sight and clear vision and the right answers immediately. And any of us who have really accompanied a loved one or been through an illness ourselves just know that that's not always the case.
So have you had situations where you thought you had the big breakthrough with a patient, only to discover that 6 months later they were doing the same thing?
I think every doctor who's in practice has had situations like that. We all see patients who we are certain are going to be safe who turn out to make a serious suicide attempt. We all see patients who we believe are absolutely not psychotic who then it turns out reveal to us that they've been having symptoms that are far more worrisome. So we have to rely on the information we can glean from our patients, and it's not always the whole story.
You mentioned that you had a patient who swallowed odd, harmful objects. You called her Lauren in the book. Is she the person you call M in the op-ed piece that ran in yesterday's Times?
She's not. These are two different patients.
And they both have similar problems?
Yes. So Lauren was someone who really uniquely swallowed objects when she was subjecting herself to self-harm. This is a maladaptive pattern that she developed in order to try to self-soothe in periods of distress. The patient M that I wrote about.
What kinds of things was she swallowing?
Lauren in the book swallowed knives, ninja blades, bed springs, barbecue skewers.
And they soothed her?
It's impossible for those of us who don't engage in self-injury to understand, but in the same way that some psychiatric patients might cut themselves or burn themselves to relieve suffering, she would swallow these objects, feel better, take herself to the emergency room to have them removed, and this would be a way in which she tried to cope with her stress.
So she was going to the emergency room, not to a psychiatric ward.
That's right. I mean, for her, she absolutely needed medical care at the moment. She had done something that could prove to be medically catastrophic. So she needed at that moment to go to the emergency room so that she could be admitted to have those objects removed.
You say that she suffered from something called foreign body?
So foreign body ingestion is the way that those symptoms are described. It's sort of an evocative term. I like the term of a foreign body on the inside, but that's how it's termed. If someone comes in and has swallowed something, it says that, and we say that they've swallowed a foreign body.
How do you treat someone like Lauren who, after leaving the hospital, faces a world full of objects that have a potential for more swallowing?
One of the things that I write about in the book and also wrote about in the op-ed piece is patients like her that are terrifically complex patients that cost an enormous amount of time and energy and money to the medical system really need intensive outpatient care, that they're ill-served by coming to the hospital over and over again and receiving emergent medical treatment and then hospital psychiatric services. This really is someone who needs a longitudinal outpatient plan, but fewer and fewer resources are available for someone like her to obtain those services.
Will people like her be covered by the Affordable Health Care Act?
That's certainly the hope. I think there's really the promise that many more people will have access to outpatient psychiatric care, both with the inclusion of mental health as having parity with medical complaints, but also with the numbers of uninsured patients who will be able to obtain insurance. Certainly is the hope that she could be covered.
But it's been my what I've witnessed is that most healthcare plans, at least the ones that are in place today, really are reluctant to pay for any psychiatric care.
My hope is that with the enaction of parity, that that will change, that plans will no longer have the option to say, we'll pay for your medical treatment, but we won't pay for your psychiatric care.
Because that's a pre-existing condition, isn't it?
For many patients, it is. Yes.
My guest is Christine Montross, M-O-N-T-R-O-S-S, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Human Behavior and Co-Director of the Medical Humanities and Bioethics Scholarly Concentration at the Warren Alpert Medical School, Brown University. She's also a practicing inpatient psychiatrist and an author. Her second book, this is?
That's right.
Falling Into the Fire, A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis. It is published by is it Penguin?
The Penguin Press, yes.
We'll be back with more right after this. My guest is Christine Montross. Her latest book, Falling Into the Fire, A Psychiatrist's Encounters with the Mind in Crisis, published by the Penguin Press. You mentioned earlier a man who thought that he was disfigured, but he wasn't. Eddie suffered from body dysmorphic disorder, BDD. That's an actual condition that how common is it?
Absolutely. So it affects one in about every 100 people, which is a shockingly high number for an illness that lots of people have never even heard of before.
What did he think he looked like?
So he believed that he had repulsive, terribly disfigured skin that had been disfigured by acne scars, and he sought procedure after procedure to try to alleviate what he perceived to be scars, when in fact, if you or I looked at him, we wouldn't notice anything remarkable about his skin at all.
Had something triggered that condition?
So there's lots and lots of research going on to try to determine the etiology of body dysmorphic disorder at the moment. And the reality is probably several things contribute to a predisposition to the illness. But for him, it wasn't as if you could look back and say, oh, you know, people mocked his skin, or there wasn't anything particularly traceable. It was just a belief that he had come to really hold so firmly over time and couldn't escape.
Well, how is that all that different from anorexia, where somebody has a distorted view of the way he or she looks?
So there certainly are some parallels, and there has been some research done comparing the two. The difference is anorexia is so linked to body weight, and body dysmorphic disorder can take any number of forms. People can believe that their noses cause people to turn away in distaste. They can believe that their hair is thinning terribly and is terrifically noticeable. So their symptoms they can believe that their thighs are repulsive to people. They focus on a particular body part, but it isn't as related to weight and total body fitness as anorexia might be.
And they often go to doctors in the specialty involved. And how often do doctors like dermatologists actually do something for Eddie, despite the fact that he doesn't really need it?
I think we don't have the precise numbers on that, but I think definitely plastic surgeons encounter these patients all the time, and it can be very, very difficult because unlike someone who may come in and say, I've always hated my nose, I'd like to have a procedure to make my nose look the way I imagine it, they get the procedure, they like it very much, they're done with it. These are patients who, because their belief is a delusional one, they're never satisfied by the procedures that take place, and often the procedures are really treating an imaginary defect.
Well, in some cases, BDD patients seek selective or elective amputations, don't they?
So these are two different illnesses. Body dysmorphic disorder is distinct from that illness that you described, which is body integrity identity disorder. That's a much smaller number of patients, and this is a distinct illness where people believe that they were meant to be amputees. So two different disorders, but confusing because the acronyms are similar.
And will a respectable doctor amputate?
Right now, that's not permitted in any major hospital. There there was a surgeon in the UK who performed amputations on these patients who believed that they were meant to be amputees. And the difference with these patients, unlike patients with body dysmorphic disorder, whose belief persists no matter what is done, the compelling and sort of puzzling thing about patients with BIID is that once the limb has been amputated, their symptoms resolve. They feel as though they are in the body now that they were meant to be in. So the surgeon who did these surgeries in the UK describes them as some of the most fulfilling surgeries that he had ever done, but quickly he was sanctioned. His hospital no longer provides those services, and it poses a real ethical quandary as to how to treat someone with those symptoms.
Well, how do you treat them? I think that doctor should have been punished for doing that.
Yeah.
That's my personal take on it. Cutting off somebody's leg because they or arm or what limbs in general?
Yeah, so that's a huge evocative question. I think we don't know what the right way is to treat these patients. And again, I want to say this is not an illness that's in the DSM. This is a very small number of patients. But it does introduce some of the really interesting questions about psychiatry because from what we understand, this is an illness in the brain that creates feelings about a part of the body that's a healthy limb. So yet people suffer terribly because they believe they really were meant to be someone without a right arm, or they really were meant to be someone with both legs amputated above the knee. And when they have had those procedures done, or many of these patients inflict the procedures upon themselves, so they go through very dramatic and sort of disturbing means of losing their limbs on their own, they feel completely at ease afterwards. So is it the wrong thing to do to amputate these limbs? Are we treating a illness of the brain by cutting off a healthy limb? What does that mean?
Well, what is the alternative treatment for people with these delusions?
No alternative treatment exists.
So they get talked to. They get put on medications.
Yeah. There was a quote in my book where a doctor said psychotherapy does not help these people a scrap. There's no benefit shown by medication or psychotherapy at this point.
The talking cure doesn't seem to work with schizophrenic patients either. You write in your book, your most memorable patient encounters come from interactions with these schizophrenic patients.
I think sometimes there's a level of rawness and vulnerability in patients who are schizophrenic, so that what they say is sometimes laid so very plain. They don't always have the reservations that the rest of us may have. And sometimes those are humorous interactions. Sometimes those are terrifying interactions, but they certainly are poignant one way or the other.
Well, one of the patients you talk about is Colin. Why was he particularly memorable?
So this was a young man who had recently graduated from a prestigious liberal arts college. He was doing some metalworking art, and he came in believing that he had a really enhanced connection with the universe. He was feeling love emanating from inanimate objects. He felt like he was in a time of particular connection with the universe, and he was following around a figure called Amma, the hugging saint, through the Western U.S.
Now, this is a real woman who claims to have comforted 32 million people.
I had never heard of Amma before I met Colin, and I admit that at first I thought this was someone that was a figment of his imagination, but in fact, no, she's a spiritual figure who performs this sacred act of darshan, she calls it, where she hugs people, and that's her way of trying to soothe people who are suffering.
Well, how does following someone like that differ from any serious religious devotion?
That was why I was so interested in writing about Colin. I think this question of how do we differentiate divinity from madness, and does psychiatry today leave room for divine encounters that we might have embraced centuries ago, and how do we draw the line and come to understand what's an illness that requires treatment and what's just an extraordinary religious devotion?
And Colin might very well have been called a saint in an earlier time.
That's right.
And people who heard God's voice and then, like Joan of Arc, and then went out and led an army, we don't talk about them in psychiatric terms.
Right. Yet I imagine if someone came in saying exactly what Joan of Arc said, that she had heard visions to overthrow the British government, I can think of any number of homeland security and psychiatric interventions that might take place today. So I think my job is to try to determine, is this a divine encounter or is this an illness that has the potential to do real harm?
Well, in Colin's case, he's not harming anybody, is he?
No, he's not.
Not even himself.
Well, I think that's where the question lies. That when he came into the psychiatric hospital, his girlfriend was worried about him. He hadn't been eating and drinking. And so I think, again, there's that question of, is it a religious fast? Or is this something that really is that he's losing touch with his ability to care for himself? And I think often George Eliot, Oliver Sacks, and others have written about how there's this sort of delusion or chimera of hyper-wellness that can precede a fall. And certainly many times with patients with bipolar illness, I've seen people in periods of mania who come in feeling better than they've ever felt before and feeling this kind of magical connection to things, and then it precedes a great and dangerous fall.
The way a psychiatrist can treat them, because you're a doctor, is with medications. And I was witness to a situation where somebody who had serious problems almost seemed to be a guinea pig for a doctor. He'd call the doctor, say, I'm starting to hear voices. The doctor said, well, up this and down that other drug. It didn't seem to work. How reliant are psychiatrists today on medication?
I think that there's a story that's told often that psychiatrists are sort of beholden to big pharma and that we don't have tools at our disposal that can really help. And patients even sometimes come in and use that exact terminology. I don't want to be a guinea pig. I don't want to be medicated into a stupor. The reality is we have some medications that work very, very well. We have medications that have been proven to alleviate some of the most severe psychiatric symptoms. They don't always work in all patients. And I think sometimes, you know, this is where diagnosis plays a real role too. You have to be sure that that you're prescribing the correct medication for the correct syndrome, and not that you're prescribing medicines for depression for someone who really isn't depressed, for example.
But also body chemistry changes, doesn't it? So what might be effective on Monday might not be effective on Wednesday.
Fortunately, I think there's not that rapid a fluctuation. And I think that goes back to your original point, which is psychiatrists are medically trained. So we have to have an understanding of how these chemicals respond in the body.
How much do people rely on the talking cure these days?
It really depends on the population. It depends on the illness. You know, one of the things that I mentioned in the op-ed piece that you and I talked about is that increasingly psychotherapy is not paid for or reimbursed at a rate that would encourage people to utilize it as much as they maybe should. So I think there's a real shift going on in psychiatry and psychotherapy at the moment, and I think we're still in the midst of that sea change.
You, as I mentioned earlier, had an opinion piece in yesterday's New York Times, and you wrote that our failure to provide a critical basic level of outpatient psychiatric care to the mentally ill creates a volatile cycle in which uninsured or underinsured patients avail themselves of treatment only when they are in crisis. This is analogous to refusing to treat hypertensive patients or to monitor their blood pressure unless they show up in the ER after having had a stroke.
That's right. So the patients who are uninsured or underinsured come over and over to the emergency room because they've not been able to afford their medications, they've not seen a clinician, and their symptoms that had perhaps been stabilized in the hospital recur over and over. Whereas if these patients had been able to be monitored and in comprehensive outpatient treatment, their stabilization could have continued, the crisis could have been averted. But I think it's exactly analogous to we provide consistent outpatient care for diabetic patients, hypertensive patients. We insist that they monitor their blood sugar and their blood pressure and that they have access to the medications that help those parameters stay in an acceptable range. Psychiatric patients don't always have that level of care, and we must provide outpatient treatment to them that prevents them from showing up in danger over and over again.
So is it a matter of us paying for them in the emergency room instead of paying for them in the psychiatric ward?
I think we need to pay for them to receive outpatient care instead of having them show up over and over again in the emergency room. And one of the points that I made in the op-ed piece is a single inpatient hospitalization for a psychiatric patient costs more than a year of outpatient treatment does. So it's not even economically sound for us to deny outpatient care to these ill folks.
For many years, psychiatry was filled with infighting over whether Freud was right, Jung was right, Adler was right, and Horn-Eye was right, etc. Has that all died down?
I think any discipline has its heroes and its pariahs. I think there are people who ascribe themselves to one doctrine over another to this day. But I think increasingly we're using a broad-based approach of neuroscience and pharmaceutical options and also some nods to the big thinkers of the past and trying to use all the tools we have at our disposal to help people who are really struggling in their day-to-day lives with these illnesses that we hope to treat.
You started treating people when you were just in your residency.
Yes.
And there are many people who are concerned about residencies in general. The inexperienced doctor winds up seeing more difficult cases than he or she will when they're in private practice.
I think that's certainly sometimes true. And, you know, Atul Gawande has written brilliantly about this and about how there are all kinds of professions, airline pilots and surgeons and others who, you know, there's a point at which you're a beginner and you have people's lives in your hands. That's true for all of us who are beginning physicians. But I was fortunate to be in a program that had really wonderful supervision. And I think many of us understand in the psychiatric world that we have colleagues to whom we can go to talk over issues and obtain supervision should we need it.
And the medical schools are better about preparing people today than they were in the past?
I don't know. I didn't go to medical school in the past, but I certainly think that there's more emphasis on treating patients humanely. It's a less paternalistic approach than I understand it to have been historically. And, you know, patients are coming in increasingly educated about their conditions and their concerns. And I think that's a good thing. We're forced to really talk with them as equal partners in their care.
Now, we've talked about a number of conditions that seem to be untreatable at the moment. In the past, extreme measures were taken, including putting an apple core into someone's brain to relieve certain problems. We no longer would do that sort of thing. Shock therapy seems to be enjoying a new kind of popularity.
Yes,
something that we considered to be rather crude medicine in the past. Are we still just searching around?
Well, we're searching around in a much more dignified and results-driven way, I think. I mean, one of the things that I wrote about in my book was when there was a period of in the 19th century and early 20th century when there was a period of gynosurgery for most psychiatric complaints. So people were really obsessed with the idea that women in particular had symptoms of hysteria that originated in their ovaries. So Charcot, instead of looking at the brain on autopsy, was looking at the ovaries.
I think, and that's why we have hysterical, because refers to ovaries.
Refers to the uterus. That's right. So I think we understand so much more about the brain and the illnesses we're treating these days. Are we still searching? Yes, but I think we will until we find treatments for these people.
Christine Montrose is an assistant professor of psychiatry, human behavior, and co-director of the Medical Humanities and Bioethics Scholarly Concentration at Brown University. Her book, Falling into the Fire, published by Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
It was a delight. Thank you.